Like a backstage pass to the world of fly fishing travel, this is Waypoints, the podcast of destination angling. News and events, helpful travel tips, destination profiles, great stories, and expert advice from some of the most seasoned and experienced names in fishing travel. Waypoints is brought to you by Yellow Dog Fly Fishing Adventures, the industry's number one specialty travel company for the very best insider knowledge, logistical support, and trip preparation. Freshwater or saltwater, international or domestic, Yellow Dog has you covered for your next fishing adventure. And now, your Waypoints host, Yellow Dog founder and director, Jim Klug.
Dylan Tomina is a writer, Patagonia ambassador, conservationist, and an outspoken wild fish advocate. He's the producer of the critically acclaimed film Artificial, and is also one of the hottest authors in fly fishing. His work has appeared in the Fly Fish Journal, The Drake, Fly Fisherman, and numerous other publications. His first book, titled Closer to the Ground, An Outdoor Family's Year on the Water, in the Woods, and at the Table, was released in 2013. His new book, called Headwaters, The Adventures, Obsession, and Evolution of a Fly Fisherman, was released in April of 2022. Since that time, Dylan has been hard at work with a book tour that has taken him around the country. Dylan is joining us on this episode of Waypoints to discuss the new book and talk steelhead, wild fish advocacy, travel, and meshing a fishing lifestyle with the demands of family and fatherhood. We'll be right back with our guest, Dylan Tomina. This is Jim Klug, host of the Waypoints podcast. As an experienced traveler, I know choosing the right equipment is everything, especially when I'm headed to remote destinations. For more than 20 years, Fish Pond has pioneered gear design for anglers with craftsmanship, sustainable fabrics, and functionality derived from decades of experience traveling and fishing the world. From Fish Pond's submersible duffels and technical fishing packs to fly boxes and thoughtfully designed luggage, the systems that carry our gear make a real difference in how our long days on the water and our nights in far-off places are remembered. Visit fishpondusa.com/waypoints to take a look at some of my favorite travel gear. As a special offer for Waypoints listeners, enter the code Waypoints, all uppercase, at checkout and receive a free gift when ordering. When you take the road less traveled, make sure you travel with Fish Pond. Author, filmmaker, and wild fish advocate Dylan Tomina, welcome to Waypoints and congratulations on the new book.
Well, thanks for having me along, Jim. It's great to be here. And are you going to tell your listeners how come we're doing this 3 months later than we'd planned?
You're a hard man to pin down, but it's good. We're finally getting to record this, and I've been excited to have you on the show for a long time. So I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, yeah, no, I actually apologize just for people listening. I was booked to do this in June when I was in Bozeman for a book reading, and was excited to do it. And I was staying at my friend Craig Matthews' place down on the Madison, and we were all set to go up to Bozeman, and we got a last minute invitation to fish Odell Spring Creek. And so I ratted out on it. And so it's my bad, but we're here doing it. And I'm excited to be doing it now.
That's always an acceptable reason on this program, by the way. You know, good fishing and fishing on waters like Odell's, that's totally acceptable for postponement. No problem.
Well, I was sitting on Craig's couch, and I said, I got to respond. I don't know what to say. And Craig said, oh, it's Jim, just tell him the truth. He'll understand.
Oh, of course we understand. Yes. Got to have priorities. That's important. Well, Headwaters, Dylan, the new book, this is a collection of essays and stories from your life as a self-proclaimed fly fishing bum, a life that is taking you fly rod in hand from your home waters in the Northwest to the far reaches of the globe. This is quite a project.
Yeah, well, it's less a project than just sort of what I was doing anyway. But it was, it's really, I think, for me, gratifying to put it all in one place and have it kind of tell a bigger story across the arc of, you know, how a fisherman changes over time.
Well, I had read a number of the individual stories from the book that had previously been published in different magazines, but with Headwaters, you've put together a collection of writing that includes, you know, humor pieces, interesting angler profiles, destination stories, and of course, in-depth environmental advocacy on topics that include dam removal, the problems with hatcheries, and the declining numbers of wild steelhead. You cover a lot of ground in this new book.
Well, it's, yeah, I think, well, that's just the result of 25 years of typing. you end up covering a lot of different things, and hopefully when they're together, it tells a more coherent story around kind of what's gone on for me as a fisherman, but also in the politics of fish conservation, in my travel habits, all the different things that have kind of changed over time. And I think, you're probably not the same fisherman you were 20 years ago either. And I'm thinking that's how most people, there's sort of this rubric around the evolution of a fly fisherman. You've seen the thing where it's like, you just want to catch a fish, and then you want to catch a lot of fish, and then you want to catch a tough fish or a big fish. And that, I don't think that really applies to me, but it's that idea of showing how you think about fishing and fish and how it changes.
Well, one thing I loved about the book too, you also have some amazing artwork in there from our mutual friend, Francie Ashforth, which is really cool. The cover work and then some sketches throughout the book.
Yeah. Francie's been a great friend and, is certainly a dedicated environmentalist and fisherman or angler, I'm learning to say now. So I don't want to be part of the patriarchy. I'm trying to be a little more, aware of that. But yeah, Francie, unbelievably talented artist. And I met her basically because I stumbled across one of her beautiful water and sky prints online years ago and thought, oh, I need this. Like, and so I kind of tracked her down and sent her a note and said, I don't have any money, but I really love your art, and she just, she's such a generous soul that just out of the blue, she sent me a package of, pieces that she'd done that hadn't sold, and cards and notes and letters and all these different things that she'd produced. And if you look around behind me in my office, there's a lot of little pieces of hers that are there. And in my house, I have some of her really big prints and a small oil painting of hers that, I look at it every day. And my immediate thought when they were looking for illustrations, when the publisher said, hey, we need some illustrations in here, was to call Francie. And she and I collaborated over months and months of what are the drawings, what's the cover, how are we going to do this? And she hit it out of the park. I mean, I if nothing else, it's really a beautiful physical book, and owe a lot of that to Francie.
Well, tell us, why the name Headwaters for the new book?
Because all the good names were taken. to me, it was really about the headwaters are the beginnings of something, right? And then of a watershed, and you can trace the impact of the headwaters down all the way to the ocean eventually. And it felt like, you've read the book, I think, and there's little vignettes, like snapshots of life from the time this fisherman was very, very young to present day. And so I felt like it starts at the headwaters and becomes a creek and a stream and a fork and a river and an estuary. And so I guess it's, for lack of anything better to say, it's kind of a metaphor for the process that we all go through as anglers.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your background, Dylan. You were born and raised in the Pacific Northwest, correct?
Yeah, Corvallis, Oregon was my first home.
Well, Tom Bye's probably pretty excited about that, being a Beavs fan himself.
Yeah, that's a hard row to hoe if you're a sports fan these days. Unless you're a baseball fan, they got an amazing baseball program there. But yeah, Corvallis was a great place for a fish obsessed kid to grow up because there's a couple of creeks that run through town that had good numbers of cutthroat in them. And the Willamette is right there that had all kinds of fish. And then it was a relatively short drive over to the coast or to the east side of the Willamette Valley for steelhead and salmon. And then the ocean is, an hour and a half away. And so mostly, though, I spent a lot of that time on my bike with the fly rod across the handlebars, just kind of learning it, trying to figure it out anyway on my own.
Well, and you write in the new book about how when you were quite young, along with the adventures on your bicycle with your fly rod, your mother used to drive you to fishing spots every weekend, and she would actually sit in the car and study while you went out and spent the day on the water. That's some great parenting right there.
Well, yeah, I mean, first, you know, big round of applause for the selfless sort of unconditional love of my mom. It was, yeah, I mean, I look back now and I'm crazy and I have kids and I got work and all that stuff. And so to think about being able to do that is pretty mind-blowing level of sacrifice. And I think it was my parents divorced when I was 10. And so I was living with my mom. My dad lived in another state. And so she knew her kid was fishing obsessed, but she herself didn't know anything about fishing. And so the best she could do was every Sunday I'd pick out some place during the week and read about it and try and call fly shops and get information, whatever it was. And Sunday morning we'd wake up and pack up the car and drive someplace. And then she was a grad student, so she'd have all her papers and stuff out on the dashboard to study. And I would, you know, bumble around on one river or another trying to figure out how to catch fish.
Well, and in your new book, you talk about that. You also talk about the influences of your father on the fishing. But, you know, how do you think that these combined events and both of your parents' willingness to kind of nurture and support your love for fishing, how has that influenced you today with your own kids?
Well, I think there was a lot of, I don't think if you asked either of my parents if it was a sacrifice, I don't think they would call it that, you know, because that's what parents do, right? And so, but it had a huge impact on me because when my kids were born, you know, they were out fishing with me and crabbing and shrimping and looking for mushrooms and whatever. And I felt like, you know, if I could bring them along and make them part of the activities, it would be somehow good. And maybe it was just selfish because I wanted to go do those things and couldn't find babysitting. I don't, but it's changed a lot. You know, you start to realize, you know, both my kids played or are playing pretty like high level travel sports, youth sports. And so that's very time intensive for a parent, especially as far as, you know, driving, transportation and that sort of thing. And so what I realized at some point, maybe about 5 years ago, that when the kids were small, if we wanted to do things together, they did what I wanted to do, right? Like I just brought them along. We'd get in the boat or we'd jump in the car and go somewhere and fish or do whatever. And as they sort of grew and found some of their own separate interests, it became clear to me that if we wanted to spend time together, it was now time for me to do what they wanted to do. And so I've spent a tremendous amount of time in gyms across the state cheering. And, you know, I think every time I felt like I didn't want to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to catch the ferry to drive to some random town, I would think about my mom taking me to go fishing or my dad finding time to take me fishing. And so, it didn't feel like a sacrifice. And, but I'm also happen to be a sports fan and love watching my kids play. So that's that, it wasn't without its fun as well.
Well, hardcore devoted steelhead anglers have a reputation as being gluttons for punishment, Dylan. For those listening to this episode, for those that are listening who are not steelhead anglers, give the short explanation for this addiction. What's the draw versus, say, chasing big brown trout or chasing bonefish or permit on the flats? Why steelhead? What is it about it that is so addicting?
Well, I think it's I wrote about this a little bit, but it really is the classic case of repeating the same action over and over again and hoping for a different outcome, you know, which is sort of this pop psychology version of insanity, right? And so there's some of that. Steelhead fishing is so different from all the other forms of fishing in that it's not nearly as visual, at least as far as your eye contact with the fish, right? So you see fish rising and you cast to them if you're trout fishing, or, you know, you spot a permit on the flats and you cast to it, or more in my case, the guide spots the permit and then you blunder around wondering where it is until it's too late. But, And steelhead fishing, there's visual parts of it, of looking for seams and places in the water and how your fly's fishing and stuff. But it is strange in that, you know, you can go days and days without seeing a fish. And so it's I don't know. I think it's the mystery of it, of, you know, is the fish even there? They're migratory, right? So you could be fishing a wonderful piece of, with trout fishing, like, you know, they're there. It's just, what are they eating? You just have to solve the puzzle. With steelhead fishing, I think a lot of the times, especially now, given the population numbers, they might not even be there. And there's something that I think is appealing to crazy people that about that mystery. And it really comes down to when it does happen and you get a grab and it connects, it almost feels miraculous.
Well, glutton for punishment, no doubt about it. It's but it is amazing and super addicting. Back to the book, I want to ask you about this, and you touched on this just a second ago, but as you mentioned, you've arranged the new book chronologically, which allows the reader to kind of follow your lifelong journey as a fisherman, as a father, and especially as a wild fish advocate. And then, as you talked about, you intersperse these kind of short intro segments throughout the book that read as your personal journal entries from the time you were a kid growing up and into fatherhood. And you called these the snapshots of your memories of fishing. This is a super personal way to connect with readers versus, say, just a collection of essays. I mean, when you put these little snippets in there that follows your life, it's an interesting way to connect.
Well, yeah, I think it's either egomania gone wild, right? Like, hey, let me tell you all about me. Or, you know, in my mind, it was a way, because I feel like there's a lot of universal emotions or connections around fishing that anglers all around the world can share. And it may not be specifically the exact same incidences, but the goal with that was to really try and show this lifetime arc of memories around fishing and connect it in a way that I hoped that when people read it, there's some kind of a bell will ring, maybe not on all of them, but you know, that somebody can say, oh, you know, I remember this or I remember that. And to have somebody, I think, reading it and feel like there's some kind of personal connection or some kind of simpatico happening, that to me, it made it feel like it would be easier to get into and understand the longer pieces. Like it's sort of a context setting thing. And I think, you know, all of my fishing buddies, once you get them going, they all have these little snapshots or brief memories of different fishing trips or things that happened while they were fishing through their life. And so banking on the idea that some of that was universal, that was my attempt to put that in there.
Well, it's a super effective connection technique. And one thing that I loved about the book also as a father is that, you know, your two kids, they play a big part in some of the stories and certainly the journey throughout the new book. The topic of fatherhood is something that's kind of woven throughout quite a few of your stories. Share with us your thoughts, Dylan, on the importance of outdoor connectivity for kids these days.
Well, first of all, I want to say that, like, one of the things in life that I'm most thankful for is that with all the distractions of modern life and being a Gen Z kid in high school, that the fact that my kids still want to go fish with their old man, to me is like, you know, that's a huge, huge joy in my life that, you know, we just went and fished in Alaska together as a graduation gift for my daughter who just graduated from high school. And those moments, like, I just, you know, I mean, I feel like I get a little choked up just thinking about how lucky that is that we can share that. So that would be the first thing I'd say. I think there's a lot of decision making around outdoor pursuits. You know, do I go upstream or downstream? You know, do I fish on top or do I go to a sink tip? Do I, you know, use this big bright fly or this little dark fly? All those sort of things, I think, for me anyway, it was really helpful of how to make decisions. You know, when you arrive at a river, there's these series of decisions. And so to share that with my kids felt really important. And then I think just the idea of finding happiness and pleasure in being outside, it's not that far of a reach to realize that, oh, we need to protect these things, right? And, you know, that there is a, you know, with our population growth and you know, manifest destiny is kind of ended because we got to the West Coast and there's nowhere else to go. You know, the fact that the resources are being used up, I feel like, is an important thing for my kids to learn anyway, as far as advocacy. And so that's the hope, is that I think that you feel some responsibility. I think it's really hard to be an outdoorsman today or an outdoors person and not feel some of that responsibility just implicitly, that you know, whether you're fighting for public lands or to clean up and protect your home river or whatever those things are, that, you know, you'd have to be kind of blind to just think you can go out there and fish and not worry about those things, or hike or pick mushrooms or whatever it is that any person's into doing. And so I think that's a long-winded answer, but to have the kids be a part of the joy of being outside and doing those things comes with that responsibility. At least that's what I hope that they're learning.
Yeah, good words for sure. And I want to come back to that and actually approach that from a little different angle here in a second, because I think that's such an important topic. But one thing I wanted to ask you about, so the back of your book features some quotes from Tom McGuane and Monty Burke, who are two of my all-time favorite writers, arguably two of the truly great modern outdoor writers, at least in my opinion. You obviously count these two as big influences in your writing life, it seems.
Yeah. Well, Tom McGuane has been, like, I don't even know how to describe it. I mean, he's been really generous with his time. I tell people all the time, you know, one of the great moments in my life, probably other than my kids being born, was a day that Tom McGuane said he'd write the foreword to my first book, to Closer to the Ground. And then shortly after that, when he sent it, it was so beautifully thought out and so Tom McGuane in its writing that I was super touched, but I also was like, the foreword might be better than the rest of the book. So McGuane's been an influence. I was a huge fan of his writing from way back with An Outside Chance. And, you know, he has this unique ability, you know, I think not just in fishing writing, I think in nonfiction in general, that he can't be touched. Like, he's just so good. And the unique ability that he has is to write about any subject, whether even if you don't have any interest in that subject, and rivet you to the page when you're reading it. You know, he wrote the book Some Horses, and I actually have kind of I would just say that I'm not a huge fan of horses, which is, people are booing everywhere I can hear. What's not to love about horses? But he wrote this book about horses, and I thought, oh, geez, this is going to be a drag, but I'll read it. I couldn't put it down. Like, it was so fascinating and so well written. And, you know, I carry around pieces of paper sometimes with just sentences that he's written that I've read, that I retype in my own hand as practice, because he's so beautiful with his words. And then he has also, you know, later became a really good friend and a mentor, and, you know, helped me a lot with my writing and sort of the business of writing. And so, I almost wish I hadn't read all his books 100 times so that I could come to them again, because I love them so much. And then Monty Burke, I'll tell you this, there's some of these new guys, you know, Chris Dombrowski, Monty Burke, have written really beautiful books about fly fishing recently. And, you know, I'll add Callan Wink to that. You know, he's a novelist, but he's a fishing guide in Montana in the summers. Those three guys, I've admired their work, really loved their books. Never met them, don't know them, no personal connection whatsoever. And I probably shouldn't say this, because other people might do this and they could get deluged. But I tracked them down through Instagram, and basically sent him notes saying, hey, you don't know me. I've written this book. It might be of interest to you. Would you write a review for me for a publication? And every single one of them within 24 hours wrote back, would love to, let me know when you need it. Please send me the manuscript. I mean, it was amazing. They had no idea who, I mean, you know, just, so I think one of the things I've learned from that is just the generosity of spirit in this very small community of fishing writers. And again, all of their work, I really, really admire. I mean, it's hard to write a fishing book because there's been so many great writers that have done it, you know, and, you know, I think McGuane's probably out there at the top of my list. You know, Jim Harrison, you know, I think of the big three, I think of McGuane, Harrison, and Russell Chatham as, you know, sort of the top three of the influences on my writing. Not that I feel like I could be as good as them or whatever, but I those are the ones that are sort of the classics in my mind of modern outdoor writing. I mean, Russell Chatham's story, The Great Duck Misunderstanding, has to be one of the like greatest outdoor stories ever written. You know, and Harrison's, I mean, I just started laughing. I even think of the titles, you know, he has the one story called Ice Fishing, the Moronic Sport. And, you know, it's wonderful. So, there's sort of an awareness, I think, of really standing on the shoulders of giants when you try and publish a fishing book and realize how many great words have been put on a page by these writers that are you know, I'll say this one more thing about McGuane is that when I read his writing, like it's shocking to me that he has the same toolbox as me. Like he's, you know, he has the same 26 letters of the English alphabet, and somehow he arranges them in ways that are so beautiful and so incisive and sharp and smart that you almost feel like not writing, because, you know, I feel like when I'm writing, like I got this box of broken crayons and I'm trying to just scribble out something, and there's McGuane with these just beautiful sentences, and I don't know, it's kind of daunting.
Well, how about some of your other influences? How about some of your biggest non-literary, non-author influences and mentors in your fly fishing life?
Ooh, boy, I think there's a little bit about this in the book, in that the things that, like, there's sort of three worlds that kind of dominate my life outside of fatherhood, but outside of being a parent. And, you know, it's fishing, it's writing, and it's conservation. And the thing that all three of those sort of worlds have in common is there's just this constant generosity of spirit, that there are people in every one of those circles that if you ask for help, somebody will step up and take your hand and kind of be your mentor, you know? And so in the literary world, you know, McGuane's been really helpful. And David Guterson, the novelist who wrote Snow Falling on Cedars, has been really helpful. I only have a literary agent because of him, went way out of his way. The other guys that I mentioned earlier, again, going out of their way. And in the fishing world, you know, I started out as this 10-year-old kid with the single mom who would park on the side of the road, and I spent an entire year trying to catch a steelhead and didn't. And, you know, she called the kind of the big time local fishing guide, Andy Landforce, who I'm happy to report is, I think he's 104 years old now, and he sent me a Christmas card and said he doesn't feel a day over 100. And he became really my first, you know, other than my dad, this fishing mentor that whenever he had a cancellation, he'd call and take me fishing and, you know, showed me how to tie knots. And I mean, really just generosity of spirit again. And that's been a constant through my life from, you know, Mike Kinney, who mentored a lot of people in the steelhead community in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, he has his disciples are like, you know, Scott O'Donnell and Deck Hogan and all those guys came up under Kinney. And Mike Kinney, who, you know, knows more about steelhead fly fishing you know, than probably anybody, because he lives like a steelhead, you know, and thinks like a steelhead. Bob Clay, up on the Kispiox, has been I've learned a ton from him. And again, just the most generous spirit you could imagine. I mean, it goes on and on that I imagine you've probably experienced this too, that there's just so many people that are willing to help you in the fishing world. And then in the conservation world, I know I'm forgetting people here. Please, if you're listening to this, it's all in the really long acknowledgments in the book. I think I did a better job of making sure I mentioned all the influences. But, you know, in the conservation world, it really starts with my friendship with Yvonne Chouinard, who never teaches you a lesson by telling you something. It's more kind of by inference and example, and you kind of learn through what he's doing. And he's been a great friend for a lot of years. And, you know, I'd say that he had an impact really on just how I think and live on a day-to-day basis. And like he has for probably hundreds, if not thousands of people through his writing and how he runs his business. And then, you know, I would say Kurt Beardsley at the Wild Fish Conservancy and, you know, Tom Derry with Native Fish Society. There's been, and then also at Patagonia, Lisa Pike, who was the head of their environmental initiatives for years, and now Hans Kohl, who runs that program. All of those people, I would say, oh my God, you know, steelhead are going extinct. I'm freaking out. What can I do? And every time those people have said, okay, let's think this out. You know, here's who we should talk to. This is what we should do. I feel almost sort of overwhelmed when I think how generous all these people have been with their time and their thinking and their friendship.
Well, you mentioned Yvonne Chouinard and Patagonia as a company. You've become kind of a big deal within that Patagonia universe over the years. And, you've worked as a brand ambassador for the company for quite a while. And in fact, they are the publishers of both of your books. I recently learned, I thought this was pretty fascinating, that you were the person behind Patagonia's famous "Don't Buy This" advertising campaign from 2011. And this was your idea.
Yeah, I came up with it. So there's a whole strange story because when I met Tom McGuane, I had gone to interview him actually for a Sage catalog. So I make a living as a commercial writer. And so I was, for 11 years, I wrote the Sage catalog. And so I had this idea to go interview people that I really admired. And at that time, I didn't know him. And so this is sort of a long, convoluted story, but Tom and I eventually became really good friends. And like I said earlier, he became kind of my writing mentor. And he's very good friends with Chouinard. And so he was fishing with Chouinard somewhere and said, hey, this guy Dylan's a commercial writer. He might be able to help you out. And with Patagonia, and this is years and years ago. And so out of the blue, I got a phone call from Yvonne Chouinard, and he said, hey, you know, why don't you come down here and let's talk about if we can do some work together. And I said, okay, like what, is this a job? Is it an assignment? Or what? He's like, I don't know. Just come down and we'll talk. And so I went down there to their place in Southern California and stayed at their house and spent a week there just kind of walking around and fishing and just doing their daily life. And eventually he said, hey, why don't you, you know, come and do some projects with us. And so he had recommended me to their creative director at the time, Hal Arneson, and Hal hired me and said, hey, why don't you go just come up with some concepts for things we could do in our marketing. And I said, okay. And so one of, you know, many, I sent him like 20 concepts, and one of them was an ad that said, don't buy this jacket. And people were pretty nervous about it. Like, that's like the opposite of what you're supposed to do with marketing, you know? And so I think there was some of this, what, are you crazy? Like, what's wrong with you? And so it sat in a drawer there for 3 or 4 years. And then somebody found it and resurrected it. And it ended up being like a billboard in Times Square in New York City. And in a bunch of magazines. So that was the story of that.
And that was a huge campaign. I mean, for those listeners that don't remember this one, in the 2011 Black Friday edition of the New York Times featured this massive, audacious, full-page Patagonia ad that told viewers not to buy the jacket that was pictured. They said, you know, don't buy this. They below the jacket's image, they had a message detailing why customers shouldn't buy the product. They listed things like the 36 gallons of water that was required to produce the jacket, the 20 pounds of carbon dioxide emitted, the amount of waste produced. And the ad was not at all successful in its stated purpose of telling people not to buy it, because sales rose 30% following that campaign. It was a massively successful campaign, but it did raise awareness of an increasing problem. And, you know, since then, like, there's been like entire podcasts and TED Talks that have been built around that singular campaign. Pretty famous ad.
Well, I guess you could look at it as sort of disingenuous, right? Because we're saying don't buy our jacket. And then a lot of people went out and bought the jacket. But to me, the real point of that was just to ring a bell for people that everything you buy has an impact on the planet, you know? And so in that way, I feel like it was really successful because it got people talking. I think, you know, before that came out, my guess is most people never thought about water usage with a pair of jeans they bought or something, you know, like that. So I feel like I can at least legitimize my role in that by saying, like, okay, it might have increased consumerism a little bit, but it raised awareness around something that I think people didn't think about. At least that's how I legitimize it to myself, so I don't feel totally hypocritical, you know.
Yeah, I think it definitely
did.
I'll
also say, you know, as far as Patagonia publishing my books, I have an agent that shopped the manuscripts around, and we had we had a number of other offers to publish both of these books. And it was really interesting to me. It was kind of an eye-opening view into the world of publishing, in that the other offers that came were from, you know, well-known New York publishing houses. But they were all really clear that we'll publish your book, but we're not going to promote it. And I thought, well, what's the point? Like, why would you even do that? You know, and my agent carefully explained to me, you know, she said, well, you know, if a publishing house brings out 50 books in a year, they put all their promotional money into one or two of them, and the rest of them are just hedges in case by some miraculous thing it hits a home run, then they own it, you know. And it was very different when we sent the manuscript to Patagonia, in that they basically said, we love this book. We're going to care for it. We're going to make it beautiful. We're going to send you on tours. We're going to get you whatever publicity you need to promote this book. And we're going to make sure people understand and read your book. And my initial reaction had been, oh, no, I want to go with a name New York publisher, because it's, you know, there's some prestige, I think, probably my ego. But my agent and Tom McGuane and other people in the industry were really clear, like, this is a really rare opportunity to have a publisher. You know, I mean, these are books you never heard of by a guy whose name you can't pronounce, right? Like, so to have somebody say, like, hey, we're really going to care for this book, which I think you can see, I mean, they're physically beautiful books. And they allowed collaboration from me with the design of the books themselves, and a lot of things we wouldn't have received. And so, the first book, it was a tough decision, and the second book, it was a slam dunk. I thought, you know, this is my ideal place for publication. So I'm hugely thankful to Carla, who's the head of Patagonia Books Division, for really, just, I don't know there's another publisher that cares for each individual book the way they do.
Well, I have to say, on your website bio and in the book, you describe yourself as a recovering fly fish bum, the phrase that you use. And I had to ask, is that actually a thing? Can fish bums truly recover or ever evolve? I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, maybe that's also a little disingenuous. I mean, I think, you know, the thought process of wanting to be fishing, I don't think ever really goes away. I think the experience of fishing changes, and then your responsibility around that fishing, as well as the other parts of your life as you build a family or do those things, I think forces people out of being like the real definition of a fish bum, you know, that, on the other hand, I have friends that still are kind of vagabonds that are, you know, just going fishing all the time. But for me, it was really trying to, I say recovering because it's been a process of trying to balance, you know, my craziness around fish with sort of real life, like a mortgage to pay and, you know, kids' college fund and sort of all these other things. And so, yeah, I think it's an evolution. I think it's it is a present tense recovering process.
A one day at a time type scenario, right? When you wake up.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, the parallels of any other addiction are, I think, pretty clear. And it may not be a substance. It might be a pastime or a pursuit or an obsession or whatever it is. But yeah, I think you can be pretty addicted to fishing and it can take over your life and sometimes can lead to disastrous consequences, you know, of which I have experienced personally. And so, you know, I mean, my evolution or recovery is a process that's ongoing and that there have been, you know, I've fallen off the wagon a few times along the way.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your film, Dylan, Artificial. You're the producer of the project, I think the co-producer. This is a film about people, rivers, and the fight for the future of wild fish. It explores wild salmon's kind of slide towards extinction, the threats posed by fish hatcheries and fish farms, and our continued loss, I guess you would say, of faith in nature. Now, I've seen the film a number of times, but I just rewatched it this past week, knowing we were going to be talking about it. And honestly, it's an incredibly great film, but it's kind of hard to watch. I mean, you watch it and you kind of walk away with this holy shit mindset of like, what are we going to do? I mean, it's a powerful film.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the kind words. I mean, like a lot of things anybody does, it's an experiment, right? Like, can we do this? And again, it was one of those cases where, it was based on this talk that I was giving. You know, I was going around, you know, I did all this research when my personal home water fishery crashed in 2000. I felt really desperate. And so I spent this time, I did all this research about what were the causes of this. And the one thing that kept coming up is that the fish hatcheries are counterintuitive. You know, you put more fish in and then you actually get less back harvestable numbers of fish. And that was so shocking to me because I, like everyone else, thought, well, if we put more fish in there, there'll be more fish coming back, you know? And so, I was so sort of blown away by all this research and the people I talked to. I created this talk and I was going around to, you know, anybody that would listen. And, you know, sometimes it would be a nice crowd and sometimes it would be like two drunk guys, you know, heckling me. And so I got really frustrated because I was spending all this time and money trying to get this information out there. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll write something and publish it about it. And so I wrote a series of stories, a couple of which are in the book, and they appeared in, you know, the usual fishing magazines and it was crickets. Like I heard nothing back from it. And around that time, I was sort of peripherally involved in another Patagonia film called Damnation and had gone to a bunch of the screenings and gave some talks at the events when Damnation was touring. And I thought, geez, this is amazing. Like the emotional impact that a film can carry around something. I mean, before I was part of Damnation, I didn't know you could take dams out. Like to me, they're like the Grand Canyon. It's like this giant edifice that's just there forever, you know? And so that was a real learning process. And I spent a bunch of time with Matt Stecker, who was the sort of the idea guy behind that film. And Ben Knight, who was the director, who's a brilliant, I mean, Ben Knight, another creative mentor that I can't say enough about. And it started to just become so clear to me, like, we got to somehow make a film. But But blowing up dams is cinematic and big and interesting. And like fish hatcheries are kind of a dud. Like, how do we do that? You know, so I brought it to Patagonia and said, hey, like, this is a real problem. How can we do this? And once again, you know, the company stepped up and said, oh, absolutely. You know, what kind of budget do you need? Who do you want to direct this? Like, let's do it, you know? And they did it in a really big way, you know? And, I think it's like 4 million views on YouTube or something now. And, so it was another part of sort of my educational process of, you know, and I don't know that it's changed the conversation yet. I mean, I think it's just part of sort of the overall long-term, you know, we're not going to go out and just blow up hatcheries. So it, you know, you have to have kind of these pieces in place. And so, but yeah, I think it turned out well. It was really exciting for me to be able to tour with it on when it was first touring and talk to people about kind of the issues and the problems that we were facing and what some of the solutions might be. But I agree with you. I mean, it's a pretty heavy film. It's, you know, I think the hardest part for me to swallow about what it says in the film is that there's a really easy solution. Like, we could just save the money and not fund these hatcheries and good things will happen. But it's so ingrained in our politics and, you know, there's a lot of money involved. There, like a lot of political things, there's a lot of money involved. It's a difficult battle. It's ongoing.
Well, I think, Dylan, we could easily do multiple episodes on the subjects of hatcheries and fish farms. And it's indeed a super deep rabbit hole that we could go down. But I will just say this. I would tell our listeners, if you haven't watched the film Artificial, you got to do it. It's on YouTube. It's also on the Patagonia website where you can watch it. It is an absolutely amazing project. And if you're an angler, do yourself a favor and watch this film, Artificial. It is absolutely incredible. You know, on that note, I want to say there is a constant theme in both that movie, and Artificial, and also in the new book, Headwaters, about man's belief that we can somehow outperform or improve on Mother Nature, be it hatcheries, management policies, or the belief that we can simply out-engineer the environmental damage that's been done for so many years. In the beginning of the film Artificial, your friend Yvon Chouinard is being interviewed, and he drops some pretty powerful words that really resonated with me. And he states, quote, "Humans have always sought themselves as superior to nature, and it's gotten us into a lot of trouble." And I loved that line when he said that. Does this pretty much, in your mindset, does this sum up, you know, kind of the thinking that has guided these hatchery policies and on a larger scale, fish and wildlife management in the U.S. really since like the 1800s? I mean, that we can somehow outperform and improve upon Mother Nature?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's hubris or you know, it is... It's human nature, right? So like to go against that is sort of having to fight human nature, you know, in that at least Western human nature, that we tend to believe that if nature is doing this thing and we mess it up, we'll just fix it. Or if nature is doing this thing and it's pretty good, we'll make it better. You know, And I'm not sure what it is. Like, I'm not sure why that's such a deep piece of our psychology. I think, you know, in the American West, I think a lot of it has to do with this manifest destiny idea that we're going to explore farther west and we're going to develop and take what we need as we go. And, you know, that there's this sort of, I don't know, pioneer psychology that can be done. And it's very counter to, I think, what existed among indigenous people here before the European sort of conquest of North America. And that conquest, somebody in the film talks about this idea of command and control of nature, you know, and boy, it's a deep psychology. I want to believe in it. It makes me feel better if I can think that I can somehow fix the damage I've done, you know, and hatcheries are such a classic piece of that psychology, because if we can count on hatcheries to mitigate environmental damage, then environmental damage doesn't become a problem for industry, right? We can build our shopping malls, we can cut down the forest, we can build dams, because every time we do that, we have this mitigation engineered solution of putting a hatchery in. And so I think it's really hard for people to believe that hatcheries don't work because of, you know, the psychology we talked about earlier. You put more, you get more. But also there's so much industry that is dependent on that belief that, you know, if I find out that building a dam, that I can't mitigate it, that the hatchery doesn't work, or if I'm going to mine right next to the stream, or I'm going to log that watershed, or build my shopping mall or my houses or whatever it is, without hatcheries as the crutch, all of a sudden, all of this development stuff becomes almost impossible to do. And, you know, I think that's the hard pill to swallow, because all of us are in some ways economically dependent on a lot of this industry. So, I don't know what the easy solution is. I mean, I've thought about it a ton, and I think it's economics, but it's also just sort of this psychology of feeling like we can fix things or we can make them better. And it's turning out that in a lot of these cases, we can't, you know, or if we can, we haven't figured it out yet how to do it. And the hatcheries seemed like a good idea 150 years ago. And as they're proving to be ineffective, and, you know, just on the West Coast, we spend billions of dollars on these hatchery programs. Very hard to let go, especially if you are, you know, a lobbyist for some kind of extractive industry that those hatcheries are letting you continue your business. It's very hard to let it go. So I don't think, you know, we're not just fighting the hatchery complex or industry itself. We're really having to fight human nature, psychology, and this giant economy crutch that they allow resource extraction to continue. And so, yeah, so it's an uphill battle for sure.
Yeah, no easy solutions, but it certainly starts with awareness of what's going on. And I think, you know, between your writing and your films, you've done such an amazing job of kind of bringing these issues together in a concise manner that people can really understand, and certainly as an angler or a sportsman that they can relate to, which I, you know, kudos for all the work you've done on that. It's been amazing. But I have to say,
I just want to add one more thing to that, is that the other, like the political piece of that is treaty obligation fulfillment, you know, and that is a really difficult issue. And that is, you know, that the United States government made treaties with sovereign nations, which are the tribes. And a lot of the fulfillment of those treaties is somewhat dependent on the hatchery system right now. And so I think that's a really thorny piece of this that's important to call out. And, you know, I want to be clear that I am fully supportive of fulfilling those treaty rights. And I just hope that we can get to a place where the abundance of salmon and steelhead is available for harvest for all the parties, that all the stakeholders that are there. And, you know, I would put tribal rights at the very top of that pecking order, because those are signed, sealed documents and agreements with sovereign nations. So I think it's sometimes been interpreted that if you're anti-hatchery, you're anti-treaty or anti-tribal or whatever that is. And I just want to be clear on that it's something that needs to be worked out and can't just be ignored.
Yeah, it is a complex issue, to say the least.
Yeah, it's simple on one hand. Let's just save that money and invest in more teachers and all those sort of things. But there are all these other political pieces to the puzzle that that there aren't any easy solutions.
Well, since this is a podcast, Dylan, that does largely focus on fishing travel, I want to pivot the conversation a little bit and steer things towards destination angling. Now, people say that fly fishing is synonymous with road trips. We've heard that a lot in a lot of different ways. I would take that a bit further, and I'd say that these days, fly fishing has really kind of become synonymous with travel in so many ways. You've also been bitten by the travel bug as your career has possessed, and you've ventured out into new waters.
Yeah, I always say I love going places. I just hate getting there. And, you know, some of those stories in there are sort of pretty far flung places with pretty arduous travel. But, you know, I think, you know, you almost come to a place. I mean, I'd love to hear your perspective on this, where fishing becomes sort of the excuse to spend time with people you love in beautiful places. Right. And it gives you a reason to not just be a tourist. Right. Like you have a purpose when you go somewhere. And I have very little interest in just flying somewhere and then walking around with my mouth open. Like I that's very difficult for me to do, but going there with a fly rod creates this sense of purpose where you're tuned into sort of the weather patterns and the local culture and geography and topography. And so to me, the fly fishing travel is just sort of a deeper way to experience different places. And ideally you're doing it with someone or some people that you love being with. And it's a time where you can have these really sort of intense, deep times of, you know, the fishing itself almost becomes secondary. I don't know. Does that make sense to you? Like, Jim, is that like...
Yeah. I mean, I think you nailed it. I've talked about this a lot and, you know, one of the key things you just mentioned there is the culture. You're probably not going to see that, you know, on a giant cruise ship or on a packaged tour trip to some popular destination. You know, the thing about fly fishing travel is it's almost always taking you to places that you would never in a million years ever be there were it not for the fishing itself. So you're seeing a different part of the world. You're seeing different places that are oftentimes so far off the grid or so remote that make them, you know, that much more special, certainly that much more authentic when it comes to a cultural aspect. But yeah, I mean, the fishing is secondary in so many of these travels. Yeah, we all want to go and, you know, have a great action and catch some fish and come home with some fun stories. But it's rarely about the fishing when it's a true, you know, travel adventure like this.
Yeah, I think that's sort of where I'm at from my perspective, too, that yes, I would love it to catch a bunch of fish and your target species and, you know, personal best and all that sort of stuff is awesome. But when I think back to a lot of these, you know, trips that I've done, I remember a lot more about things somebody said or what it looked like when we were at a place or, you know, I worked in Bristol Bay for 5 summers as a guide way back when I was really young and had not been back until this summer, just last month. I took my kids up there and we had a wonderful time. But the thing that really struck me is how the tundra smells. Like that it was just this very nostalgic sort of thing that was almost overwhelming. And those little pieces, when you travel to fish, as opposed to just travel to sightsee, the process of fishing gives you at least a glimpse of being part of what's happening there rather than an observer to what's happening there. And so I think that to me, that's the most sort of outstanding value of going to some place to fish that's not your home waters.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know that, you know, as you've kind of, you started out as a steelheader and that's still, you know, a key part of your identity and who you are, but through writing and connections over the years, you've been able to branch out. And I know through reading, you know, your books, you've visited Christmas Island, Cuba, Russia, Japan, Argentina, you've been to a lot of these places. This is a question that I'm going to ask it, even though it's my least favorite question when people ask it to me, because I think it's a tough one to answer. But do you have any favorite international destinations? And actually, let's do this. Let's take out Northwest locations, Western Canada, nothing having to do with steelhead. Aside from that, do you have any favorite destinations?
You just ruined my whole, Skeena River system dialogue there.
It's too predictable. Yeah, wow. Of course you were going to say that.
Yeah, so. This went from a really easy question to a really hard question, Jim. Like now I got to really think about this. Wow, that there's so much. Boy, there's so much. There's so many like just amazing experiences and places that I've been. If we take out the fishing, well, there's two pieces to this, I'll say, in answer to this question. One is, if you come from a steelhead fishing background, you are every guide and lodge's favorite client, because you'll go somewhere and they'll say, oh, God, so sorry that fishing has been so bad. You know, you only landed 4 fish today. And the steelhead guy is going, holy smokes, this is unbelievable. This is the best fishing I've ever had. You know, so that gives you a leg up on every other client that's going to a travel sort of guided fishing experience, is that expectation management is in full effect, because as a steelhead fisherman, you know, if you get one a day, you're feeling really good, right? So if you go, you know, bone fishing and it's real slow and you get 3 fish in a day and everybody's bummed out except the steelhead guy, who's like ecstatic, right? So that's been my experience with that. As far as actual favorite places, it's so tough, because there's been so many great experiences in these places. I really, really enjoyed the 3 hours of Atlantic salmon fishing I had on the Karlovka River in Russia. If I had the money, I would do a lot more of that. I'd like to go to Iceland. I'd like to go to, you know, Northern Norway. Russia's kind of off the plate right now. But I would really like, that's one of the places where I'm like, I want to do this some more. I just can't afford to do it more, but that's sort of at the top of the cake, and it's probably cheating a little bit, cause it's similar to steelhead fishing. But I really loved that. I understand Eastern Canada is having a really good season this year, and so I'm a little jealous of that. But outside of that, boy, let me think. I really liked Christmas Island a lot. I really, again, it's falling into the steelhead trap, but fishing Argentine Patagonia for sea run browns was probably a real, I've done that a couple of times and thoroughly enjoyed it. Those fish are, you want to talk about not focusing on the fish, but to focus on the fish, the sea run browns in Patagonia are incredible fish. I mean, I think I had in my mind like, oh, they're just like brown trout you catch anywhere, but they're bigger. And I had no idea that they were going to make these insane runs with their backs half out of the water and jump 5 feet in the air. I mean, that's a crazy experience too. Those are, you know, I guess not surprisingly that a lot of my preference is things that are similar to steelhead fishing. But the kids and I usually spend a week every summer in Montana just fishing dry flies for trout, which I really love. Really, really enjoyed, you know, believe it or not, fishing for a 6-inch Yamame in Japan. That was kind of a cultural thing, being Japanese American and having not been to Japan before, to go do that in the fishing context was super, super eye opening. I loved Cuba. I don't know. I'm very Catholic in my tastes around travel. Like if there's somewhere to go and some cool people to hang out with, like I want to do it.
And that's a hard question to answer. I hate it when I get that one, so I apologize. But I always like everybody's perspective on some of the things they've seen and done, for sure. Regarding travel, sticking with this, you have a great paragraph in the foreword of the new book that talks about the impacts of our travels on the planet. You write, quote, "What about the footprint left by my travels? Does advocacy for wild fish make up for the damage caused by planes, helicopters, jet boats, and trucks employed purely for recreation?" Pretty solid question. That one hit me right away when I first read it.
Yeah. How can you not think about that stuff, right? Like, we're so focused, I think, on, well, you know, people who are focused on this at all, I think you think more about sort of your home fishery, your, you know, and it's easy. I think for me, I fall into this trap all the time that when I travel to fish, I'm kind of unaware of whatever environmental problems are going on there, or, you know, it's easier to just say I'm spending my week here and I'm fishing. and not want sort of all the politics to come into play that you deal with on your home water. So the my initial impulse is to kind of ignore it and say, hey, I'm on vacation, I'm here to fish. But the fact remains that, you know, a lot of what we do is pretty transportation intensive. You know, jet boats, helicopters, float planes, all that sort of stuff. And I don't know that there's a real solution to it other than that if you make the attempt, I think you can learn about what some of the conservation issues are, where you're going, and that you can support those issues from afar, whether it's financially or whether it's awareness raising or whatever it is. I think that to me, that seems like that should just be kind of part of the cost of a trip, is some level of engagement or infra. There's been a lot of talk about this around like surcharges at lodges for conservation stuff. And I don't know enough about it to really know. I know they've talked about it on the Skeena, that there's a conservation tax. Like basically if you have guided days or you stay at a lodge, that they add $100 a day or something as a contribution. I don't know how widespread that is in the travel fishing world, but
some are doing it. Some lodges are doing it. They've started doing like a conservation or a community fee that's essentially based on that.
Yeah, and that may be one of the solutions. I don't know. I mean, I think it's just important, like you said earlier, to start with awareness. You know, ask the people, and usually the local guides or your contacts there are pretty keenly aware of protecting the resource they're making a living from. And so I think that's one good strategy. I think, you know, if it's doable, I mean, I think just more regionally and locally here, I've been at the point where I feel like, you know, this is a big ask, but I feel like fishermen really should be spending about an equal amount of time and money on conservation as they are on the fishing itself. And that can be time or money or some combination of those things. And 50%, you know, 50-50, that's a pretty big ask. But, and I know that that's out of reach of a lot of people, but I feel like that's sort of the key, what we're going to need to do to protect cold water fisheries at home. And so maybe some of that needs to apply to our travel as well. And I'd love to talk to you about this sometime, since you're a travel guy. Like, you know, what are the solutions? How can we make this part of what people are doing? And, you know, I don't think it means we shouldn't travel. I just think it means that we need to be aware of some of the issues that we're causing by our presence and our travel. And then also what's going on in these places that we go to, because even these pristine places, you go to Bristol Bay and do a fly out and don't see anybody all day, but Pebble Mine is looming right behind you, you know. And same thing, you go to southern Argentina and you go fish, and actually they're talking about building a dam on Rio Santa Cruz. And, you know, there's all these things that are happening even in very remote parts of the world. So I think it starts with awareness there.
Oh, for sure. And you know, I think a lot of people in our industry have been proponents, and this is something we've talked a lot about on this show, is the fact that our fishery resources, you know, the environments that we depend on, the ecosystems, you know, where we fish and where the fish, obviously, you know, what they depend on, these ecosystems, they desperately need advocates and voices. And, you know, it can be argued that this only happens when you have engaged and active numbers, right? I mean, our fish and our rivers need a voice. But with declining fish numbers in so many places around the world, you know, how do we find that balance? You know, you want engaged, active people on the water speaking up for the resources and being, you know, advocates. But at the same time, you got to find a balance on what can be handled. So it's an interesting topic for sure. But certainly more important in the politically charged world that we live in these days.
You find yourself in a place where almost any subject is pretty divisive these days. And, you know, and being a conservationist, or, you know, is frequently not the most popular, position to be in. But, you know, I think Bristol Bay is a really good example of a lot of different diverse groups, from tribal entities to commercial fishermen, to the sport fishing business up there. Building a really strong coalition, you know, and of course the conservation NGOs that are active there, building a coalition that's been pretty effective as far as advocacy around the whole Pebble issue. So, I think that sort of gives me hope that traveling anglers can actually play a part, an important part in protecting things that are important to all of us. I mean, we all lose if there's no fish, right? So there's every reason why gear fishermen and fly fishermen and commercial fishermen should be on the same page everywhere.
Well, let me ask you this. You've written these books, you've worked on these film projects, you've been heavily involved in all of these issues that we've touched on in this episode today. Do you feel, Dylan, that, you know, are we past the point of no return on these issues, or do you personally maintain some optimism for the future? And I guess, you know, the fact that you're a steelhead addict, you have to be an optimist by just, you know, by nature. But what are your thoughts for the future? I mean, are we past the point of no return, or is there some hope?
But as a steelhead fisherman these days, it's probably stupidly optimistic. I don't know that that's an informed position. I think there's always reason for hope. I think that it's going to take work, that we can't, we're past the point now where we could coast along on things being fine and just going out and fishing. And some of that, like what we were just talking about earlier around the equal time and money for the resource as you spend fishing. I think that's going to be the key for us as anglers to be more engaged. And, you know, I think it's kind of distasteful. Like, I don't want to be involved in contentious politics. I don't want to spend some of my hard-earned dollars on these issues that should be taking care of themselves. But I think that's kind of where we're at. So, excuse me. So I think that the hope for me lies in increasing engagement. And I think what's really heartening for me is the next generation, the Gen Z that's coming into this, is a group of really motivated, politically aware kids that think about conservation by necessity in a way that we never had to, right? Like, you know, until they closed my steelhead river, the Skykomish, like, I never thought once about conservation. I just, you know, I jokingly say, but I was conservation minded, and that was conserving every penny I could for gas and pizza, you know. And so, but now I look at like my kids and their friends and talk to, you know, and some of it I think is actually one of the benefits of social media, is that there's this huge community of young anglers now, of all different backgrounds and genders and enthusiasm level that have come together through this virtual community on, you know, mostly on Instagram. But I feel like to me, that's a real hopeful sign that these aware, enthusiastic, motivated, smart, younger generation have built this community around fishing. And, you know, there's good parts and bad parts around Instagram and fishing. That's a whole other episode for you right there. But,
oh, yeah.
But I think it's created this community that didn't exist. You know, I grew up in a small town being crazy for fly fishing, and there was no fly shop. I didn't know anybody else that was fly fishing that was my age. And now there's this connection level. And so I think to be able to shift some of that enthusiasm and that community towards conservation, which is happening already to some extent, that's our real hope, is that, you know, I tell my kids all the time, like, I'm really sorry that your parents' generation blew it on climate change and all these other political things. But you can't just complain about it. Like, you're the ones that are going to have to fix it. And so I feel like my generation now, the best we can do is kind of hold the line, like try and keep it from getting worse until this next generation of voters comes into power and starts electing officials that are more concerned about conservation issues. And, you know, maybe that's misplaced hope, but I feel like that's our best shot at being able to have sort of the kind of fishing we like in perpetuity.
Well, good words, and I think a good place to end this episode. One final question for you. Again, I want to give a huge shout out for this new book. I loved it. Really enjoyed every single chapter in the book. I thought it was fantastic. Where can people find the new book, Dylan? If they want to get a copy of it, if they want to start reading it, what's the best place to find it?
The easiest place is the giant merchandise retailer whose name I will not say. That delivers very quickly. But it's, we have really good distribution. So it's at most, you know, local independent bookstores, which I support. And if they don't have it, they can order it from their distributor. Online, you can get it directly from Patagonia on the Patagonia website in the book section. That goes along with Patagonia being a member of 1% for the planet. So some of that money will go towards good causes. But basically anywhere you buy books, it will be available.
Well, Dylan Tomina, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your insights. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Brian. It's this is a great conversation, and thanks everyone who's listening. I hope you like the book. It was a labor of love, and I'm excited to hear what you think about it. If anybody needs to reach me, they can DM me on Instagram and I'll field all complaints or good reviews as well.
Excellent. Well, that's it for this latest episode of Waypoints, the podcast that is 100% dedicated to travel, adventure, and exploration. Be sure to visit yellowdogflyfishing.com to plan and research your next fishing trip, sign up for newsletters and new podcasts, and stay up to date on the latest travel news and developments. Join us for our next episode of Waypoints, and remember, life is short, and no one ever regretted a life of adventure.
This has been another episode of Waypoints, the podcast of fly fishing travel and adventure angling. Waypoints is produced by Brian Gregson, with music provided by the Steep Canyon Rangers. Visit yellowdogflyfishing.com for more destination profiles, travel news, and expert advice, and be sure to join us for our next episode.